Well, welcome everyone. This is Duke Clark, and this is my podcast on Stories for Joshua. I'm continuing on with my life story, I guess you could call it, as I'm putting in these posts. Day 18, Granddaddy was a man of God. I always respected Granddaddy. He worked hard, he was funny, he was intelligent, and he was kind. I remember him being as fit as he could be, hard rock muscles, and he could work circles around anyone. And Grandmama had the same work ethic. That's one reason Daddy was a complete mystery to me. He was the total opposite of them. One of my favorite memories of Granddaddy was sitting on the side porch while he smoked his cigar. To this day, I love the smell of cigars. Grandmama wouldn't let him smoke in the house, so he had to go outside to do it. We didn't talk when we were out there. He was usually thinking or writing something down, and I was just a little kid, so there wasn't much to talk about, but I didn't care. I'd like to share more of Granddaddy's story here with you, if you don't mind. Again, it's a little longer than usual, but hopefully it'll be entertaining enough. It's the spring of 1918, in his first year of his ministry. After the cool weather at Easter, winter turned rapidly into spring. The earth had been frozen for so long and covered with deep snow, it came forth again, clean as a hound's tooth. The whole earth took on a fresh and virgin look like it might have been the first day of creation. The moon was strong at night, and the sun seemed near to the earth, trying in its own way to make up for lost time. Owls began to hoot in the deep woods. Pheasants beat their wings on hollow logs at night, making a sound like a far-off motorboat dragging a heavy log on the bottom of the river. Nature rose up like a mighty sleeping giant and strode across the valleys and hills, leaving a thick green coat of growth. The hard winter sub-zero temperature of sleet and ice had destroyed all the usual crop of insects. This allowed the plants to reach maturity rapidly and without any handicap. As the snow and ice melted from the slopes above, Laurel Creek became pregnant with new life. The clear crystal waters, purified by nature, moved through the Dalton Meadows by the farm of John Cox and toward the wider opening of New River. Life was once again fresh and the whole world was young. The barnyard of chickens began to increase their range of forage after being closed in for the winter. The extra growth of hair on the horses made a shaggy appearance. They were soon neatly trimmed and presented a more pleasing look. All animals had been stuffed with dry roughage during the winter, and now they moved across the green earth to get an equal share of the ever-increasing food supply. Many birds died during the hard winter, mostly from starvation, but there were also many who survived. These that survived came forth with beautiful color in their plumage. Never have I seen more red in the cardinals or blue in the bluebirds. For the surviving, however, both the animals and people, it was worth the hardships involved just to the opportunity of walking over clean, fresh earth and to feel the balm of the noonday sun once again. The churches over the circuit were reopened for regular monthly preaching appointments. For the month of May, I walked to each engagement. It was usually on a Saturday afternoon, having supper, spending night, and preaching the next day, and then returning home at night. The preacher could stay just about anywhere in the community or at houses along the way. Everyone expected to give him a meal and lodging for the night. For the most part, everyone was glad to have the preacher come and stay with them. They thought of him as a holy man and one who knew the great mysteries of life. Then, too, they knew that he always had news from other parts of the countryside that he could share, and since there was no other line of communication, this was very valuable. They talked to me, searching for information and also for more strength to live their lives. They didn't know it, but I received much more from them than I was ever able to give in return. Walking to the appointment soon became a rugged task. It required more energy and determination than did the whole preaching program. I usually went on an empty stomach, as rations were low and lean at the parsonage. It was imperative to leave enough food to make up at least 2 meals during my absence so my wife had enough to eat. Had a hunger strike been proclaimed by the president, who usually proclaims a day for every kind of project, my wife and I would have outlasted even the strongest in the country, as it is with the adage, practice makes perfect. We sure had enough practice on our own. Good old Doc McMillan of Chestnut Hills saw my plight and took me under his wing. He started talking about a horse even before he had said a single word about it. Arrangements had already been made to get me one. I was to pay $65 for the deal, which was an honest bargain, and I was allowed plenty of time to pay off the debt. Later that summer, I hired myself out to do work at the grain harvest and paid off the horse, a Western saddle, which was another $35, and some saddlebags to carry my things in. With this outfit, I rode in style to conquer the northwest corner of my world, a real circuit rider at this point. I named my horse Kate. She was a bay mare about 17 years old and weighed about 900 pounds. She was a mountain horse brought up on the river and knew all the fjords that must be crossed. Each fjord had a white rock on either side of the riverbanks, so you knew where to cross. I would get on Kate and she would take me across safely. About 8 o'clock on June 15th, 1918, I went for the doctor. Our first baby was about to be born. I rode Kate across the ridge about a mile's distance to get Doc Everett Reeves, the only doctor in the radius of 7 miles. It was just dusk, and old Doc had just come in from his day's visits to his patients down at Roan's Creek. I told my story with some sort of enthusiasm, as one might do when running with his tongue hanging out, calling for help to put out a fire. Old Doc walked about quietly, getting ready to go into his house for supper. He told me to ride back and he would be along sometime later. But I asked, well, what if the baby comes before you arrive? Then what? He said not to worry about it. The first one is never born without the doctor. So I returned, rather puzzled about the whole thing. About 2 hours later, he came up riding his horse, which was just walking along the way, like there was nowhere in particular to go. About 11:30, the baby was born. He weighed about 10 pounds. We named him David Arthur Clark Jr. This added to our responsibility, but also to our joy. But the baby was fine in every way, and that's all we cared about. About a month later, July 13th, Kate and I, my faithful horse, began our 60-mile trip to district conference for the Methodist Church, which took me about 2 days to get there. It rained all the way there, but I wore a Fish brand slicker coat that came all the way down to my feet, a southwestern hat that shed the rain off my head, and for the most part, Kate and I remained dry and comfortable. On our first night, I rode to the only house I saw in a place called Elkland, and a lady took me in and my horse at no charge since I was a preacher. This was the first time I began to realize the sympathy most people have for the poverty of a preacher. On the second day, we arrived at the district meeting. I was housed and fed while at the meetings, for which I was very grateful. Everyone there was asked to speak their mind, and I had no intentions of doing so until I was called upon by the bishop to give a report of my work. The most natural thing for me to do was to think about the near starvation my wife and I had faced, and so I aired it all out. The arrogant Mr. Smith, a native of a local area, stood up and rebuked me, denouncing all that I had said. I immediately confirmed that what I had said was true. Maybe it wasn't that way for the well-fed Mr. Scott, but it was so in my area. I returned to the parsonage about dusk of July 16th. Agnes met me in the yard with our baby in her arms. There was a worried look on her face because the baby was really sick. I got back on Kate and rode to Doc Reeves' house. This time he came without delay. We realized for the first time that he was helpless with his meager knowledge of treating diseases. He did all that he could and remained with us through the night. Before daybreak on the next morning, July 17th, our baby died in my arms. Later, Granddaddy told me that someone brought them a small white casket to bury the baby in, and they took it to the train station and went all the way back to Granddaddy's hometown of Thomasville, North Carolina, about 100 miles away, to bury their child. Sadly, only a few locals checked in to see how they were doing, and no one offered food or help. It was a lonely time for them, but they never faltered in their mission to make God known. As hard as their lives were, to me, they were always the hardest working and kindest people I knew. I am very thankful for their lives.